The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Bear in mind, this is a teacher who had at times read what I'd written, rolled up my chapters, leaned across the desk and popped me on the head with them and said, "What were you thinking?" You know, after I'd got done writing. And I got to the end of it, but I looked at her, I just stared at her when she said that. And I said, "What?" She says, "You did it. These are professional quality writing. I do not know if this will be the first thing you sell, but you will eventually be able to sell this. Make sure you hang on to it. Come back in next week with an outline for the rest of it." And she meant the rest of the novel. Well, I rolled into her class the next week with an outline for 20 novels and a big old capstone trilogy for the end of the series, and just started babbling at the maximum word speed of my voice would allow about the entire thing. And she's just, I remember the look on her face as I'm babbling for a half an hour straight, as she's just nodding and looking at me. And the look on her face just said, "I just finally got this kid on board with what we're doing here. You know, I don't need to derail it now. I don't need to say anything right now about how it's going to be impossible for him to sell a 20-book series."
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Number one New York Times bestselling author Jim Butcher spoke to me about how he outlined a hit 20-novel series years before he had an agent, why all steampunks wear goggles, and the second book in his Cinder Spire series, The Olympian Affair. Jim's the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Dresden Files, The Codex Alera, and the Cinder Spire's novels. The long-awaited second novel in his Cinder Spire series is The Olympian Affair, described by the author as League of Extraordinary Gentlemen meets Sherlock Holmes meets Hornblower in a series about noble families, magic-wielding warriors, and airship battles. Library Journal called it an exciting epic fantasy set in the sky and filled with airships, magic, and the connections of blood and found family. And New York Times bestselling author David Weber said of the book, "It's steampunk meets magic with a dose of sci-fi for seasoning." In this file, Jim and I discussed why breaking into print is an arduous and discouraging process, the genre fiction novel class that changed his writing for good, keeping your writing time sacred, when your fans become your boss, how to write a steam opera, his most important legacy as a writer, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right. Are you ready to go, Mr. Butcher?
I am.
Awesome. All right. Well, we are back on The Writer Files. I am honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. I have our friend Jim Butcher is hanging out with us on the show today. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Absolutely.
So we had some technical difficulties, which we often have to just laugh about. But yeah, appreciate you doing this. And I'm going to take you back once again. I'd love to talk about your superhero origins as a writer, because it seems to me to be the kind of the epitome of what we talk about so much on this show, which is, you know, accepting a life of rejection and perseverance. And yeah, you've talked about some of this at length, but I'd love to get the kind of the Cliff's notes of this fantastic journey that you've had to best-selling author.
Well, I started off when I was 19 years old. I decided that I wanted to be a novelist, and I wrote my first novel, and it was terrible. I mean, it was long, but it was genuinely awful. Not to be deterred, because I knew I probably wouldn't hit a home run the first time I swung the bat. I stepped up a few months later and started writing my next novel, and it took a bit longer to finish, so I took more care with it. And I finished that one, and it also was terrible. So then I wrote three more novels, all of which were bad. And every single novel I'd written had been a swords and horses, Tolkien meets Cthulhu-esque fantasy. So after that, I decided I was going to try some kind of X-Files-y sort of thing, because the X-Files had gone off the air, fairly recently right then. And I was missing it. So I decided to write an X-Files style novel. And it was sort of X-Files meets X-Men, because I thought that lined up well. And it also was terrible. And at this point, I was taking classes with Deborah Chester in Oklahoma's School of Professional Writing. And Debbie was trying to teach me a lot of really important things about the craft of storytelling, which I was rejecting completely because I was busy with the art of writing. So I was, I didn't want to take her advice because I had a bachelor's degree in English literature. And Debbie had merely published 40 novels. So, what did she know? In her class, at one point, she suggested to me, "Hey, Jim, you've been, when we talk about storytelling and the craft of writing, you keep bringing up Buffy the Vampire Slayer on TV and examples from there, and Babylon 5. Maybe you should try writing a science fiction novel or an urban fantasy novel." To which I replied, "No, I am a fantasy writer. I know what I want to write." She was like, "Okay," and eventually. I was taking a class called Writing a Genre Fiction Novel, where what you did for the semester was write a 200 to 250 page novel. And then you got graded on it as if it had been something you were trying to sell to a professional editor in New York. And that was the class. It was a consult class where you went in every week to meet for half an hour or 45 minutes. And so I decided that I was going to prove Debbie wrong about everything she was teaching. I was at that age, and the means I decided to do that with was I was going to do everything she told me to. I was going to be her good little writing monkey. I was going to fill out all these worksheets and do these outlines and these character forms. And then she was going to see what terrible cookie cutter pablum crap emerged from that kind of process. I even agreed to write urban fantasy. So I did all that. And I wrote the first novel of the Dresden Files, which, showed her. But I remember going into that class with the first couple of chapters of the novel that would become Stormfront and handing them in to her. And the way the class worked was you came in with 50 pages and handed them over. And she took those first couple of chapters and she started reading them. And she read the chapters, and normally she would read them, she would make notes, and then you would talk about everything you'd done wrong. And instead, she reads the first couple of chapters with just a couple of scribbles in the margins, and she finishes off and squares up the pages and sets them down on her desk and looks at me and says, "You did it." Bear in mind, this is a teacher who had at times read what I'd written, rolled up my chapters, leaned across the desk and popped me on the head with them and said, "What were you thinking?" After I got done writing. And I got to the end of it, but I looked at her. I just stared at her when she said that. And I said, "What?" She says, "You did it. These are professional quality writing. I do not know if this will be the first thing you sell, but you will eventually be able to sell this. Make sure you hang on to it. Come back in next week with an outline for the rest of it." And she meant the rest of the novel. Well, I rolled into her class the next week with an outline for 20 novels and a big old capstone trilogy for the end of the series. And just started babbling at the maximum word speed of my voice would allow about the entire thing. And she's just, I remember the look on her face as I'm babbling for a half an hour straight, as she's just nodding and looking at me. And the look on her face just said, "I just finally got this kid on board with what we're doing here. I don't need to derail him now. I don't need to say anything right now about how it's going to be impossible for him to sell a 20 book series, first thing out the gate." And I got to the end of it, and I realized we were at the end of the class, and she'd hardly said a word. And I said, "What do you think?" And she looked back at me with that look of not wanting to discourage me and said, I think if we can get you to sell a 20 book series, you should be doing fine. And because she hadn't told me that it was impossible to get such a thing done, I went out and did it.
Amazing.
That was where I got started.
Yeah, it's truly a cool story and an inspiring story. And we can read more about it over on your website too, under About Jim. That's jim-pritchard.com. But yeah, I thought it was inspiring, the kind of some of the messages there about perseverance. And, you know, really what it seems that you had done was you had really studied up, you had really figured out that you needed to get in front of your work in front of exactly the right people and find out where those people were hanging out early on.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, that doesn't hurt, but I mean, after I did that, it still took me another 4 years to get published, you know, even after I turned those first pages in, because it was a matter of getting it to the right people and finding who would, you know, who would be able to, you know, finding someone who would represent me, finding someone who, you know, an editor who would be favorably disposed toward it, of being able to get out to conventions and actually meet people so that they realized, you know, they eventually came to at least recognize my face. You know, the editors, you know, they keep track of that sort of thing. They keep track of who is just not going to go away, and they take those people seriously.
Great message is, again, that stick-to-itiveness and perseverance that you have shown. And I thought it was funny that your longtime online moniker is Longshot. And of course, I chuckled when I went to your Twitter handle, Longshot Author. And of course, you talk about that a little bit, how it is kind of a long shot to get published, but not only that, but to make a decent living. And yeah, I mean, the evolution of your career has been really cool to see, kind of from a 50,000 foot view. But yeah, talk a little bit about kind of the changes that you've undertaken as you've obviously grown into this like number one New York Times bestselling series and ultimately others, written for some bigger franchises and gone on now to this new series, of course, which we'll talk about. But yeah, talk a little bit about kind of the evolution of your process and how you've kind of grown as a writer.
Well, I've got to say that I think that the most unfortunate thing about progressing in your career as a writer is how much more of your time gets taken up by things that are career related, but not actually writing, like what we're doing here today. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, it becomes incumbent upon you to do, and that it's good for you to do. But at the same time, it sort of gets harder and harder to get that quiet alone time in front of the keyboard that you need to get things done. So that is my advice to my primary advice to people who are coming out as writers is to make sure that, you know, as you keep going, that you keep that keyboard time, you guard that jealously, you keep that sacred, because without that, you can't be a writer. That said, my process hasn't really changed too much. The way I write is sort of a front loaded process. I mean, it's difficult for me to get a chapter written until I can see the whole thing in my head. And I sort of have to get all the elements and everything lined up. And once I can do that, then I can write the chapter, and it comes out pretty quick and easy. And the advantage of that process is that you usually wind up with a very clean copy because you've worked out a lot of things ahead of time. So there's not usually major edits to do by the time you get to the other end. The disadvantage, of course, is that you spend all that front-loaded time trying to get things done. And so you often can't get it done as quickly as you'd like to. Although I think that's common for every writer, writers don't write as quickly as they want to. They write as quickly as they can. And that's, you know, that can often bring them into conflict with schedules and occasionally with fans.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the fandom piece. And because you've built these very popular series. And then, of course, as you mentioned, you're kind of at a point in your career where your name is bigger than the title and you're going out to places like Comic-Con, etc., to meet the fans and your upcoming tour. Of course, you know, people are going to want to, as they always do, talk to you about all the things, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, talk a little bit about the fandom piece and again, maintaining your sanity as a writer?
I think the first thing you have to recognize if you want to be sane as a writer is that ultimately the fans are your boss. It's not your editor. It's not the publisher. The editor and the publisher also, you know, they're there to make the money from the fans. And ultimately it's the fans who decide whether or not you're going to get paid. So a lot of times I see some writers who come into conflict with fandom and the fan base. And it makes me wonder because, you know, they're the ones who are in charge of whether or not you're going to get that check. So it is incumbent upon you to think about them and to figure out what you're going to do. At the same time, though, you have to also write something that is true to yourself and your own artistic vision. And I think striking that balance of giving the readers what they want and also writing, you know, the story that is in your heart is one of those critical things you've got to do as a writer. And that can sometimes be a difficult balance for people. That said, I have a great time when I talk to my fans. I've got the coolest fans ever. You know, they show up and you know, they've got their stories about, hey, hey, Jim, I was reading this book while my father had cancer. And it was, you know, we had been estranged for 10 years when he got sick. And we both found out that we liked your books. And so as your new stuff came out, I would just sit down and read it to him, you know, and we got to reconnect before, you know, as he was in hospice or something like that. And you get these stories from folks that, you know, I never set out to do anything like that. When I'm writing my dumb little wizard stories, you know, that's how I regard it. I think that because I'm making the genuine effort to write the best story that I can and create something that people can connect over, which is what I want. I want people to have fun. I want them to be able to excitedly talk to their friends and for people to take up different, you know, opposing viewpoints on various characters and, you know, what's going to happen and how would they react to, you know, this situation that's clearly coming down the line. And, you know, because I've made that genuine effort, I think, you know, the stories connect with people. And as a result, you know, it's grown into something a lot bigger than I ever thought it would be, which has reached out and touched a lot more people than I ever thought would happen. And as a result, I'm just absolutely terrified of changing my process at this point. It's one of those, if it isn't broken, don't fix it sorts of situations. You know, I don't want to even deviate from my, you know, from my outline that I wrote way back in the day when I was in college, because apparently that college kid had something good going. I don't want to jinx him. I've gotten to the point now where it's like, okay, I don't think I can tell the story I want to tell in 20 books. It's probably going to be about 21 or 22 books. With a 3-book trilogy to finish off the whole thing. But, you know, but at this point I'm scared to change it. It's like, okay, you know what? It's working. Just keep going like you were and, you know, try not to screw it up.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, we'll circle back to that, but of course, can't wait to talk about this long anticipated second novel in the Cinder Spire series. You described it as kind of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen meets Sherlock meets Hornblower, and your contemporary peer David Weber called it steampunk meets magic with a dose of sci-fi for seasoning. And of course we're talking about The Olympian Affair, and talk about your feelings going into the launch of the latest. Of course it's been a minute, and then I don't know, yeah, what is the vibe on the eve of this latest tour?
Well, I'm very pleased with it. It was a book that I was actually considering abandoning the series and starting something else, because it had been so long since the first one, and I wasn't feeling confident about it, and I wasn't sure that there was really a fan base for it, that would be large enough to support it. And then I wound up going to Dragon Con last year and had about 20 different fans come up to me and say, hey, when's the next Cinder Spires book coming out? I really want to see what's going to happen next in that world. I hope you haven't abandoned it. And I felt so guilty because, you know, I had been considering doing exactly that, moving on to another project. And so I said, okay, you know what? The fans are there for it. I've had, you know, all these people and a bunch of people had also reached out, you know, over the internet. And so I'm like, okay, fine. I'm going to get this done. I'm going to do everything I can to make this a good book. And I sat down and kind of, you know, went and reviewed my old class notes and so on to make sure my fundamentals were still sound and started putting this book together. Because, you know, when you get right down to it, every skill, every sport, every art is all about fundamentals. So I sat down and, you know, outlined the story and did it just like I would have in class to figure out what was going to happen, and sat down and started writing it. And lo and behold, it started going really well for me. I mean, the story was really working and it really cooked along, and I got it all written in an unusually short amount of time. And from a craft perspective, I think it's one of the stronger books I've written in a while. It was certainly a whole lot of fun to write, which is always a good sign, I think. And it gets, I mean, I get to include all kinds of cool stuff. You know, I'm writing a steampunk book with duels and poison and talking cats and kaiju and airship battles and all the things that make, you know, fantasy great. So as I said, from a craft perspective, I really love the way this stands up, and it is really I think I've found sort of the vibe and the voice for the series in this book. Sometimes that takes a while to get done. And I think I've found it in book two of this one, and, you know, moving ahead, I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be a really good story. I'm really looking forward to writing the next one.
Congrats on the upcoming release of that one. And yeah, the title is, of course, The Olympian Affair. And the pub date on that one is going to be November 7th. I believe that will be published as of the publishing of this show. So yeah, you'll be out there mixing it up with your fans, glad handing a little bit and enjoying, basking in the release.
Oh, absolutely.
Very cool. I was excited to get a chance to just pick your brain a little bit, of course. And again, you know, you said that you're having fun, and it does seem like you're having fun.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you're not having fun while you're writing, you're not doing something right.
Yeah. Definitely seems like you're having a good time. And I'll just do the little blurb here of the book. For centuries, the cinder spires have safeguarded humanity, rising far above the deadly surface world. Within their halls, aristocratic houses rule, developing scientific marvels and building fleets of airships for defense and trade. And now, of course, spires hover on the brink of open war. I thought it was cool that Library Journal said that the long-awaited sequel to The Aeronauts Win Less is an exciting epic fantasy set in the sky and filled with all of the things we just mentioned, and the connections of blood and found family. Talk a little bit about the inspiration behind it. And, you know, it's interesting that you chose this kind of mashup of steampunk and all of these other really fascinating elements in your work. But it seems like that's kind of how you came out of the gates, you know, with the Dresden Files, this wizard, you know, operating out of an office in Midtown Chicago in the contemporary world. But yeah, talk a little bit about how you chose this particular mashup.
Well, what it really amounted to was, I mean, first of all, I sort of had an inspiration for a steampunk novel, and I had this idea for airships and how they would do battle. And after that, I started saying, okay, well, if this story is going to work, let me start putting, you know, various details together to see how it works. And I was having the hardest time figuring out why people would wear goggles, but I knew they were necessary because it was steampunk, and you can't do steampunk without goggles. It just won't work. So I had to start figuring out, okay, what's a good reason for them to wear goggles besides I don't want to get stuff in my eye? And so I started putting that together, which is background stuff that if I told you would sort of spoil the overstory, so I can't. But once I had finally worked that out, it's like, okay, well, if that's what's going on, then it follows that. And after that, you just sort of line up the consequences of the story you've established. So it's like, okay, well, in that case, there's going to have to be cats, and the cats are going to have to be intelligent. And so I might as well have them talk, because, you know, talking cats are a good selling point. So, you know, after we had goggles and airships, it's like, okay, well, we're going to have talking cats. And what is this world like? Oh, we're going to have to, airships are going to have to be completely vital. So what's a good way to do that? Well, what if the surface of the world is just so deadly that humans just really can't survive there with their, even with their technology? Oh, that sounds great. And so I started putting that together. And honestly, I think the series is pretty much a pure science fiction series, but nobody else sees it that way. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, I thought the Codex Alera books were science fiction as well, but nobody saw them that way.
That's interesting. Yeah, the genre characterizations are interesting. I always ask authors like how they characterize the book, because so many authors are like, "Nah, that's not really how I see it."
Yeah, I asked my editor if we could put steam opera on the spine, and she's like, "That's not a genre."
I love it. Well, yeah, I'm sure that if bookstores were to add the steam opera section, that you would just be crushing it over
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, I would be the biggest name there.
there.
If they came up, Barnes at BNN, if you're listening.
Who else is in that section?
I'm not sure who would be there. I'm sure we could find someone though.
Okay. Very cool to get to pick your brain once again. Yeah, an inspiring message, I think, nonetheless, just hearing you wax philosophical about the amount of work that you initially had to put in just to get there, and then obviously the perseverance and that arduous and discouraging process that any writer that wants to be published has to go through, but then also to maintain a series of the length, like the Dresden Files, that's and even to launch multiple best-selling series in a career has gotta be kind of interesting. As you look back, or look ahead, like what do you think as a writer, like your legacy is or will be?
Well, I think the most important legacy I've got is what I've taught my son. My son James is starting his career. He's got his first couple of novels of his first series out. And honestly, I think he's a better writer than me. He's done a lot of, I mean, he did a long apprenticeship with me where he worked to hone his skills. It took him a year less than it took me. It took him 9 years instead of 10 to get his act together. But he has also done an awful lot of learning by listening to what Sanderson has to say in his writing classes. So his style is not like mine. He's somewhere between me and Sanderson, which I think is probably a really good place to be. And I think he's going to leave me eating his dust in 10 years or so.
Yeah, that is so cool to see. And I did pop over to your Twitter and saw that. And at first I was like, oh, that's interesting. They have the same name. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's your son. That's so cool. What a great story that is.
Yeah, he's an amazing kid. He's going to do great things.
Well, that's cool. So are you still in the Rocky Mountains there in Colorado? I am, just for the record, a Denver native.
Oh, hey. Yeah, actually I'm down in Monument right now.
Cool.
And we are right at the bottom of the foothills. I still have issues. I was working on doing some crafting for a live action role play I was going to, and had a couple of mountain lions make me go inside the house because I decided to hang out in the yard that night. So yeah, I mean, I still get some of the cool issues I had when I lived in Evergreen, but I've got way better internet now.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, and Evergreen is such a quaint little place. And of course, Monument is beautiful.
We've got a street cleaner just happened to go by. He wants to park outside the window right now. Okay, now it's moving.
Of course, this has never happened on this show.
Yeah,
The lawn guys always seem to know exactly when we're going to record.
exactly.
I appreciate those guys that blow the leaves, so I was just letting them do their thing. Yeah, but it's really cool again to get to pick your brain about this really, really epic career, these epic series that you've created, and these worlds and the fandom that's been built around it. Congratulations on everything. Of course, I want to ask you one fun one before we wrap up with your final words of inspiration. But yeah, if you could have dinner or drinks or both with any author from any era to your favorite place in the world, who are we hanging out with and where are we going?
I think I'm going to have to pick Sam Clemens, Mark Twain, a fellow Missourian, and see what he has to think. I would love to hear his take on the current state of the world.
Very interesting. And where are we hanging out with Mark Twain? I mean, I'm sure that would be a
Oh, well, we're going to have to find a good steakhouse. I actually I'm going to take steakhouses, living or dead, for 500, Alex.
Whoops.
Yeah, to go hang out at I think it was called the Golden Bull, which used to be open in KC. It closed here 10 years ago or so, but they were one of those bring your steaks out, still sizzling on the plate sort of steakhouses. And they were also they also had a large selection of whiskey and bourbon. So I think Mr. Twain would appreciate that.
Oh, very nice, very nice. The whiskeys and bourbons of the world are legion, and so. Yes. Okay. So, what are we drinking? Is it Buffalo Trace, maybe?
I don't know actually. I'd let him pick. He would probably be better at it than I would.
Yeah. Well, he would probably be really happy at the selection.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. All right, Jim, we're going to let you go. But before we wrap with your final words, I'll point at, of course, your Amazon page, your home base there, the book, all the things, your Twitter, jim-butcher.com.
Or jimbutcheronline.com.
Jimbutcheronline.com.
Perfect. Yeah, just Google Jim Butcher. It'll come up.
Not a hard man to find. But we look forward to seeing you out there on tour, of course. I would love to catch you at the tattered cover, but I'm not going to be in that region during that time. But one of my favorite bookstores of all time. It's such a cool place. Your final words on just how to keep going.
Just understand that if you're a new writer, if you're an aspiring author, you have an opening that nobody else has, because the publishers have to publish new authors every year, because if they don't, eventually all the old authors die. So, you know, there is a space for you, which means you are not competing with me. You're not competing with James. You're not competing with Brandon Sanderson. You are only competing with the other newbies, with the people who are in your weight class. And if you persevere long enough, if you continue to develop your skills and your story craft long enough, you will eventually be one of the most skilled people in that class. So it's sort of like running away from a bear. You know, you don't have to be faster than the bear. You just have to be faster than the guy next to you. And writing is exactly the same thing. So for the folks who are struggling to get in, continue struggling. If you can hang in there longer than the other people, you win. It's as simple as that.
I love that. You don't have to run faster than the bear. Perfect way to end up, to wrap up this fantastic talk. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you, and best of luck out there. We appreciate your wisdom, your words, and your time. And come back anytime.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.